Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
He's unpredictable. He's relentless. He's fearless. He's smart. He's a jerk. Oh, man, what a jerk. How would you describe Kirk Minahan?
He's talented.
He's blunt.
He's complicated.
He's the fakest tough guy I know.
He's honest.
A self-proclaimed weenie.
He's angry.
He's actually a good guy.
He's a psycho big-mouth prick.
I wish we had more Kirk Minahans.
How would you describe Kirk Minahan?
Combustible.
Unpredictable.
Venomous.
Testy.
Obnoxious.
Selfish.
Polarizing.
Pompous.
Enough about me. Let's get to the show.
It's Kirk Minahan's Enough About Me.
You know, I guess the greatness of Tom Brady has lessened what Drew Bledsoe was. And Bledsoe, I think, is the athlete in Boston who was the closest to greatness without ever really getting it. But for 4 or 5 years, he was a damn good quarterback. He was the first franchise quarterback the Patriots really ever had. And if you're a Patriots fan like I was growing up, when Drew Bledsoe showed up, he changed everything. Got a chance to talk to Bledsoe here for about 40, 45 minutes. And we talked about everything. Belichick, Parcells, Brady. A lot of good stuff here from Drew Bledsoe. So I thought of you when the draft was going on, and they show you in some highlights, you know, a few times during it as a former number one pick. What was the process after you left school before you were drafted by the Patriots? How far in advance did you know that Parcells was going to take you?
You know, we thought he was, but he played his cards really tight to the vest. You know, he didn't know if he was going to take me or if he was going to take Rick Meyer. You know, we felt like he was, but, you know, usually, at least especially in that day, if you were going to be the number one overall pick, they would have the contract all negotiated and everything done prior to the draft, and Parcells wouldn't do that. So we didn't know for sure until they actually said my name that I was going to go first.
So that's like legitimate. The afternoon, the night of the draft, when the first pick came up, you didn't know if it was going to be you?
Well, we thought it was, right. But we didn't know for sure. They hadn't come out and said, "Hey, yeah, we're taking you." We thought that was going to happen, but we weren't 100% positive.
How was your dealings with Parcells leading into that?
I only met him one time. I met him at the combine, met him in a hotel room. Went up and to just do kind of a one-on-one interview, and it's pretty intimidating as a 20-year-old kid. You know, you walk in there and you got this kind of Godfather type from Jersey, you know, in the hotel room, and you're a small town kid out of you know, Walla Walla, Washington, and you got to go sit down with this guy. It was a little intimidating, but I think it was a good meeting, and obviously he must have thought it was also because he went ahead and pulled the trigger.
And you guys had a lot of history together in two different places. When you look at it now, and it's whatever, 22 years later, how do you look at your relationship overall with Parcells? I mean, do you like him today? If you run into him today somewhere, is it a good relationship?
You know, honestly, I haven't seen him or talked to him since I retired from the Cowboys.
So you haven't talked to him in 10 years?
Yeah, no, haven't seen him, haven't talked to him. So those relationships are always, you know, they're not always, you know, warm and fuzzy, and it wasn't warm and fuzzy with Bill. But I'm glad I got a chance to play for him, particularly when I was a young player. The end of the deal down there in Dallas wasn't super friendly.
Yeah, so it ended, and obviously Romo came in. You know, you got they pulled you. You, yeah. You sat for Romo, and then from that point on, it was pretty much done with Parcells.
It was a professional relationship, but he hasn't reached out to me since that point, and I haven't needed to reach out to him.
How about your relationship with Belichick? I mean, I know it sort of ended the same way, and it's been, you know, a long time as well. You've known him for a long time too, and you're more involved obviously with the Patriots today than you would be, say, with Dallas or with Parcells. How's your relationship with Belichick?
You know, it's interesting. You know, Belichick, he's such an interesting guy because when you work for him, it is all business, and everybody knows that. I mean, there's no warm and fuzzy. There's no, you know, there's no small talk. There's none of that. But since I retired, I've been back there a couple of times just for wine deals or to you know, come to a game, and he's an entirely different guy when it's not a business relationship. You know, he smiles and he's engaging and interesting, and I came back and did a wine presentation at the wine shop there at the stadium, and he came over for that and hung out, and we talked for a while afterwards, it's actually a pretty decent, pretty friendly relationship.
Did you push? Were you a voice in bringing in Belichick after Carroll? Was that somebody that you wanted to come in here? At that point, did you have that sort of say, or would you speak up in that situation?
Yeah, I didn't, I'm obviously not making those decisions,
right.
But I was in favor of that as much as anything, as I just didn't want to compete against the guy anymore. Didn't want to play against him. He was such a pain in the butt, and as a defensive coordinator, and Mr. Kraft felt the same way, and brought him in, and obviously he's gone on to be probably the greatest coach that's ever coached.
You know, we'll get back to Belichick maybe in a minute or two, but, people talk about Gronkowski all the time, and he's great. I mean, there's definitely a chance he could go down as the greatest tight end of all time. But I do feel like people around here, I grew up here, I've watched all these games. I do feel like people forget how great Ben Coates was. And it was a short time, there's no doubt. But for a 3 or 4 year stretch, he was as good as any tight end who ever played.
He was, and he broke the mold a little bit. There weren't a lot of guys. Now it seems like everybody's got a big-time tight end, but there were not a lot of guys in that era that were doing what Ben was doing. Sharp in Denver, he was catching a lot of balls, but he was more just a receiver. Ben was actually a true tight end where he was blocking in the running game and then was just a deadly weapon in the passing game. You know, he wasn't a giant guy. He wasn't big like Gronk. I mean, I think Ben was like 6'4", probably 250. But he played giant. I mean, he could catch anything. He could run over safeties. And then if he got free, he was as fast as anybody on the field. Just was a game breaker. So he was pretty special. And as a young quarterback, having a tight end like that that was so reliable and that you could throw the ball to even when he was covered and he would catch it, was a great security blanket. I remember there was a time, there was one play that we had and we would run it and it was very effective. And Parcells was saying to Ray Perkins, he's like, well, don't call that. All he's going to do is throw it to Coates. And I looked at him and I was like, well, he always catches it. So why wouldn't I throw it to him? You know, it always works. And Ben, he was just great from that standpoint. If there was nothing else that we could find to work, that was working, I'd just throw it at Ben and we'd get the offense moving.
It's a lot different today than even when you were playing. And I mean, you were always a hot button guy in Boston in radio and in print because you're the quarterback. And if you struggle, they kill you. If you play well, they love you. But it's even more intense now, but looking back at it, say 10, 15 years ago, did you like dealing with the Boston media? Did you not like it? Did you find it different in other markets? Was it more intense, less intense? I mean, you played in whatever, three different markets. How did it match up?
It was different, certainly at first. A small town kid from, I was used to being covered by one newspaper, and
right.
And out west, they might try to get after you, but it's never going to have the kind of that same tone. But to be honest with you, I enjoyed it. I mean, they don't get after you, and I knew that was the case. I remember after we played the Steelers my rookie year, and I threw five picks. I went and grabbed the papers because I just wanted to see how bad it could get. And I think one of the writers, I don't remember who it was, but one of the writers said it was the worst performance by a quarterback in the history of the New England Patriots. So I was like, okay, well, good. We can only get better from here, But that's part of the job, and when you play in Boston, that sports is more serious than it is most other places, and so I understood that, and embraced that challenge, became part of it. So I didn't not like it. I just knew that it was part of the job. But comparing Boston to the other markets, it's I went from there to Buffalo.
Well, I guess Buffalo wouldn't work as a comparison, right?
No, not really. You know, but Buffalo, I tell people playing football in Buffalo is like playing pro ball in a college town. You know, the fans were great. They were very loyal to you, but it didn't have the same edge to it as a place like Boston. And then you get to Dallas, and in Dallas, you know, you play quarterback for the Cowboys. It's like pitching for the Yankees. You know, everybody loves you or they hate you. And the media down there, you know, the one thing that I think that they had in common with the Boston media is they really feel like they know more than other fans, and the sports writers feel like they're, you know, because they're in Dallas, that they know more than other sports writers do, which is kind of interesting because, you know, obviously they don't, but it wasn't. You know, it was different. Football's number one. You know, in Texas, and you know, when I got to New England, you know, football was probably number four. And then we, you know, had an amazing run of success and got all the way up to number two behind the Red Sox. But when you're in Texas, football is religion, so that puts you at the top of the sports page all the time.
Well, you know, I think you're underselling it, to be honest with you, because, I mean, I'd say the average listener to this podcast, the ones we've done so far, are like 25, right? Maybe late 20s. I'm 41. I grew up here. Like, when you say your Patriots are number four, you're right, but they were such a distant number four. I would go to games at the old stadium, and I would go, you know, in high school, a bunch of my buddies and I would go and watch a game. The years before you got there, you know, the years with McPherson or whatever, and we'd go and there'd be Hugh Millen would be playing quarterback, Tommy Hodson, there'd be 9,000 people in the stadium. You'd start up top at halftime, then let you come down. You'd be three or four rows, you know, away from midfield. I watched Zolak win a couple of games in front of nobody. You came here. Parcells came here. You guys might not have won the Super Bowl, but everything changed. And you went from four, which is probably right, to two in about a second. And I would argue, even when you were still here, say the Super Bowl year, even that first 10-6 year, I think you guys went from four to number one, to be honest with you, even ahead of the Red Sox. I think it changed the game completely.
Well, I know we at least got into the conversation, you know. But one thing you do learn when you come to Boston is that the other sports are sports, but the Red Sox, that's church. You know, going to Fenway is going to church if you're from Boston. And so I don't know if the Patriots ever even now.
Well, now I think I think given the last, especially the last like year and a half with all the insanity, I think now it's the game has totally changed.
Sure, sure, yeah.
What is your take on that? Now you've obviously been paying attention to it, the whole Deflategate thing.
Yeah, the whole thing.
What was your pregame preparation with footballs?
Yeah, with footballs, all we would do on a Saturday, if we had a Sunday game on Saturday, we'd go out for walkthrough, and then I'd get with Donnie Brosher, Johnny Rotten, Johnny Hildebrand, and we'd get the bag of footballs out, and I would grab them, and I'd grab each football, and like, oh, that one feels good, don't like that one, and the ones that I liked would go into the good bag, and the ones I didn't would get tossed, or they'd rework them some more. But I never even knew what the PSI of a football was. I just knew what felt right. And to me, it was far more important that the balls were broken in than it was how they were inflated. You know, one thing I was talking with my brother just yesterday. One thing I've noticed in watching these guys on the field now is that the footballs that they're throwing to the quarterbacks, they're almost like black. They're so broken in and worked in. And to me, that was far more important than how inflated the ball was. That never really even entered the conversation. So, you know, and because of that, this whole deal, this whole thing, it just the fact that it's, you know, risen to the legal level that it's risen to, and you know, the next step I think is the Supreme Court.
There's a chance. So if this the Second Circuit doesn't agree to do the thing, and this en banc thing potentially with 13 judges, but you're right, there's a chance that the deflation of footballs or not is going to be in front of the Supreme Court.
Yeah, it is so ridiculous, you know, to me, and has zero impact on the game. I don't know, man. The whole thing just drives me crazy.
Did you ever, you said you didn't know the PSI, but was the term PSI ever discussed in your life in the football game? In the preparation leading into a game around the field, ever?
No, never. I just kind of assumed that The referees would grab the footballs and, oh, yeah, that feels like a football. The only thing I ever did hear was that I know that they would check to make sure that the kicking balls weren't overinflated.
Mm-hmm.
I did know that they would check that, and that to me was the only thing that I ever was aware of that they would check, because the kickers wanted the balls, you know, overstuffed so that they could kick them farther. But, you know, outside of that, it was never a thing. It just never, ever happened.
When did you start figuring it out as a starting NFL quarterback? The first year, obviously, you struggled for a while. You were out for a little bit, and Sekulis was in. Then you won your last four games. You had that game at Miami 10 in the regular season. Then you started the next season. You had that shootout with Marino. Was it about then that you started figuring it out, or was it the Minnesota game the second year? When did you say, okay, I know what I'm doing now. I've kind of got my figured it out. I know what I'm doing as an NFL quarterback.
Yeah, it's a progression. I continue to learn for a number of years, but certainly the jump from rookie year to second year, in terms of how comfortable you are and how well you know things, was a pretty dramatic jump. That was the biggest jump, in that progression. And then from there on, I continued to learn and continued to get better, you know, all the way through the end of my career. But I did get to a point, and I remember when I was the year that I was hurt, when Tommy came in at the end, I would sit with Damon Heward and as we were preparing for the games, and Damon, I remember he would ask me, he's like, all right, well, how's this game going to go? And I could break it down for him to the nth degree as to exactly how the game was going to go and what was going to decide the game. And so I got to a point where, particularly when I was not on the field, but when I was watching, I could tell you exactly which matchup was going to determine the outcome of the game, and how the flow of the game was going to go based on that matchup. So I did get to the point where I could understand the game very, very completely. And to be honest with you, toward the end of my career, that was one of the things that made it easier to make the decision to retire was, it wasn't quite the same challenge at that point, and I was really looking forward to a new challenge, intellectually. I got to the point where I knew, if my guys did their job, that I was going to execute my part of it at a very high level of precision. But I was also at the mercy of the guys around me because I wasn't going to go run around and create stuff.
How is your how's your head now? How's your brain? You took a hell. You were a tough quarterback, man. You took a hell of a beating for a long time. To your credit, how many concussions did you say you've had?
I don't know. I mean, it's probably a couple a year. But at that point, you got dinged, and you just kept playing. That's what it was, and I had an interesting deal that happened about once a year my entire career, where if I got hit in the back of the head, I would lose peripheral vision out of the left side of my head. So I'd go back on the field, and if I was looking straight forward, I couldn't see the entire left side of the field.
Now, is there a part of you at that point where you're thinking, I probably shouldn't be out in the field. This isn't a small. Or do you just say, fuck it, I got to do it. It's part of the job.
What I would do is I would we had a plan, and I would tell whatever coordinator that I had, and I had eight coordinators my last 10 years, and so this had to kind of stretch that out with each coordinator. I had to tell them, hey, this is probably going to happen at some point this season, and what we have to do, number one, let's run the ball, but number two, you need to call pass plays to the left. Because if I'm looking left, then I can peripherally see the rest of the field to the right. But if I'm looking to the right now, I can't see three quarters of the field. And so we would call things where I was looking to the left, so I could see what was going on the right.
How long would this last for?
It lasted about 20 minutes.
Jesus.
So a series, maybe two, and then it would come back. I had those kinds of things that went on. But all things considered, I feel pretty good every day. I don't have any ill effects from the hits. And it was funny though. I took one of my son's got got whacked on the lacrosse field and had to take him in to get him cleared to go back on the field. And so I'm talking to this neurologist, and he's checking Stu out and kind of giving him the whole protocol. You know, you got to sit for a few weeks and come back and see me and the whole deal. And he looks at me, he goes, "How are you doing?" And I'm like, "Oh, you know, good." He goes, "Well, how old are you?" And I think at that point I was 42. I said, "Yeah, I'm 42." He goes, "Oh, well, you know, the symptoms don't really kick until 45.
Oh, fantastic.
I'm like, "Oh, okay, great.
Great.
I've got 3 years and then I'm drooling in a cup."
But, I mean, you got out, you made a lot of money, you've been really successful
with
the wine business. Is there part of you, though, that when you think about it, and you see, I mean, listen, you play with Kevin Turner, you've seen these guys.
Sure.
Not that's going to happen, but is a part of you that is scared about what could be happening 15, 20 years from now?
You know, but you know, I can't control it, and you know, I do, you know, that I do everything that I can to kind of make sure that I'm staying as healthy as I can. I think that's one thing that, you know, that seems like common sense, but I think is really true. You know, if you stay healthy and eat right and exercise, and then you keep your brain active. You know, I think that just regardless of whether you're, you know, playing football or just living your life, if you continually challenge yourself and you're always learning, you know, I think you give yourself a better chance that your brain's going to function well for longer. So you know, I worry about it, but I don't. It doesn't keep me up at night. You know, and so far so good. You know, I forget where my keys are. And, you know, can't come up with somebody's name from time to time. But I think that has more to do with
so the why. That happens.
Than it does getting hit in the head. So far so good. I've been really fortunate, man. I got out of the game after 14 years, and you know, as you said, I certainly got hit plenty. But you know, but everything so far functions fairly well.
I was going to ask, well, I guess it's a dumb question, but I was going to ask what the worst hit you ever took was, and maybe the question is, what's the second worst hit? Or, you know, the weird thing about the Lewis thing, obviously it's no joke, I mean, you were really seriously injured, is if you watch it, you know, it looks like a hell of a hit, but you see hits like that a lot, if that makes any sense.
Sure.
So I mean, if you're watching a football game, that stuff can happen all the time. I guess it's just the speed and the angle and where the hit was, right? Do you remember?
Well,
I mean, do you remember it or no?
Yeah, and what happened was that I was, you know, and it was, you know, I mean, it was not a malicious hit by him. I don't think even in today's NFL, you know, probably not flagged or flagrant. But what happened was I was running out of bounds, and you know, it was third down, and I knew that I was just a couple yards short of the third down marker, and I wasn't going to just run out of bounds short of. You know, short of the first down marker on third down. And so I turned back in, and when I turned back in toward the field, I just exposed my entire rib cage, you know, to this, you know, very big, fast football player. And, you know, when you do that, because there are hits that happen in every game that probably have a similar level of violence, but in this instance, you know, it was a violent hit on a very exposed area rather than on my pads, and that's really what made that one, you know, such a dangerous deal. You know, but I get whacked pretty good a few other times. I remember my rookie year after I came back off of my knee injury, we're playing the Bills and started to kind of run up the middle, scramble up the middle, and you know, was even slower with the knee brace on and Phil Hansen hit me from the side, and Marcus Patton hit me right in the face with the top of his helmet. He hit me hard enough that he bent my face mask wide open. I think I took a quick little nap on the field for a second, and then got up. And I remember being on the sideline stomping on my helmet, trying to get my face mask back in line. But then at that point you just go back and play.
You played in the next series after the hit against the Jets. You came back out. Do you have any memory of that or no?
No, I remember coming back out, and then I remember, you know, the reason that I ended up out of the game was because I had a concussion, not because of we didn't know that
the bleeding
that I had the you know, bleeding situation in my ribs, but I had a concussion also, and I remember being on the field, and we had a check with me play where I was either going to go right or go left, and I knew that we needed to go left. But I couldn't come up with the word. And so I turned around to Mark Edwards and go, hey, Mark, how do I go left? He goes, say odd. I'm like, all right, odd. And then between him and Dame and Hewitt, they ratted me out and let the staff know that I wasn't thinking clearly.
And I remember, so you came back in the AFC Championship game against Pittsburgh, and in that very first series, you kind of took a hit similar to the hit in the Jets game. You remember that the first season?
It was similar, but in that one, they did initially throw a flag, and then
right,
they picked it up.
Yeah,
that one should have been flagged because I was running out of bounds.
Right,
I didn't turn back in on that one, and that's that one. I left myself exposed because I was running out of bounds, and they threw a flag on the hit, and then they picked it up, which I didn't think they should have.
At what point during that season did you realize? Well, okay, obviously this isn't going to be happening here for me anymore, or did you have it?
Yeah, you know, while I was recovering, thought that kind of after all the blood, sweat, and tears and all that I'd put into the organization, that there was going to be a chance to get back on the field when I got healthy. But then when Bill made the decision to stick with Tommy after I was healthy, obviously wasn't happy with that situation. That's when I kind of knew that it was probably not going to be a good long-term situation. Would have welcomed the chance to come in and compete for the job the next year in training camp. But when the Raiders game happened and that call got overturned and all of that, I was like, okay, that's kind of when I knew, like, okay, you know, there's this thing, I guess, is just going to happen, you know. I think and at that point, it feels like there's something larger at work than just, you know, playing football.
It's got to be a weird, you know, there's got to be part of you, you're standing there in the snow in Foxborough against the Raiders, and I think you went out for the overtime coin flip, I could be wrong, as one of the captains.
Yeah.
There must be part of you that thinks this is, you know, you're happy for your teammates, you're happy for Brady, this is great, but there's got to be part of you, it's human nature, that is like, Jesus, I can't believe this is happening.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was, you know, I mean, I've been pretty honest about it. That was emotionally for me, that was a really tough season. Really happy for my teammates and for the organization, and tried to do everything that I could to support Tommy and support the team. But you know, on a personal level, it was tough. And when Woodson comes in and hits Tommy to everybody that was watching looked like it was a fumble.
Mm-hmm.
I remember kind of taking a knee and thinking, okay, this is over. You know, I can, you know, this whole thing is over, and I can, you know, I can unwind a little bit and try to, you know, just process everything that's happened. And then when they overturned the call, I was like, oh, okay, well, then, I, you know, this thing is something different's happening here, and so I better embrace it, and I did.
Did you, when you saw Brady, you know, you saw him for a year, that year before, and then you saw him that training camp a little bit at the start of the year, did you ever think, forget, we didn't think he was going to be this, we know that, but did you ever think you were looking at the guy who was going to be a good starting quarterback in the NFL, or you just didn't know?
No, I felt like what Tommy was going to be was a guy that was going to, be a really good backup quarterback in the league, you know, for 12, 14, 15 years. You know, he was a guy that worked so hard. He was a smart guy. He's a good team guy. You know, all of those things that everybody knows so well. But especially his rookie year, man, he was just so skinny, just a little, you know, skinny little twerp, and just didn't look like, you know, a guy that was going to be a big time starting quarterback. Obviously in his mind he had different plans, and we all know what he's gone on to become. But I felt like he was going to be around for a long time. I was certainly going to be cheering for him. But certainly had no concept that he was going to, you know, go on to be a starter, let alone one of the guys that's at the very top of the game.
What didn't you know about him then that led him to do this? What didn't you see?
Well,
or couldn't you see?
I think the thing that happened for him, first of all, it was right place, right time. You know, when 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 we get midway through the season and the rest of our offensive line gets healthy, defense is playing well, special teams is stepping up, you know, all of those things are happening. It was a really good situation for him at that point. You know, I remember that year, the biggest thing that happened that year, I stepped into the huddle the first day of training camp, and I remember looking around and going, oh man, you know, we got a shot. We got an offensive line here. And, you get Woody and Compton and Light and, you know, all that. It looked like five blocks of granite. But in training camp, the guys all started getting hurt. And that starting five offensive line, I don't think they all played together again until like week five or week six. And that's really when things started to click. You know, we lost the first two, and then we won one, and then we lost the fourth one, and so they're 1-3. But then all of a sudden, those guys all get healthy, and they're back on the field, and that's when things started to change, particularly on the offensive side. Was when that happened, So Tommy played. You know, he played well that season, but the team really, really rallied around. And there's a thing that happens with a team. You know, if your quarterback goes down, then everybody feels like they've got to do a little bit more. And I think in that season in particular, guys really stepped up and took that thing to heart because they knew they had this young guy that they had to support. And then obviously Tom, you know, continued to just grind and work and he's put in the time and the effort, and that's the part of the reason that this whole deflate thing, you know, pisses me off, is because I know the kind of work that he's put in to become one of these guys. You know, that didn't just happen. He's a grinder. He works his butt off to get there, and he's done that continuously, and that really to me is the legacy of what he's done with the Patriots, has been his work ethic, his leadership, and his, you know, relentless desire to win, far more than anything that he's done throwing the football has been his legacy.
Was there ever, you know, even maybe not during that year, but in a couple of years after that, was there ever sort of a frost in your relationship with Brady? Or did you guys always get along? Have you gotten closer more as you retired?
There was always great mutual respect there between the two of us. But, you know, guy takes your job. You know, you're not just going to love that dude, you know, right away.
Sure.
You know, there was always great mutual respect and all of that. But we've been better friends, I think, since I retired, from the game. And obviously I'm a big fan of Tommy and everything that he's done. But we've had a chance to hang out a little bit over the past, three or four years, and it's a very good relationship. We keep in touch, and he was really kind. Two of the last three years, I had reached out to him, and as I'm coaching this high school football team out here, and for a couple of big games, asked him if he'd send a video to the team to get him fired up for the game, and both times he did, and our guys just loved that, which was really cool, he's been great, and we're good friends.
Did you ever deal with, and it's a guy we have on our show all the time too, did you ever deal with Schilling at all individually? You sold your house to Schilling, right?
Sold the house to him, and I think that's the only time we've ever, there are two times that we talked. Once when we were selling the house, and then on the video game, he called and wanted to pitch that thing to me, and I decided not to participate, which obviously I'm happy that I didn't jump in on that one. Haven't really spent a lot of time with Kurt.
It seemed like, you know, that team that lost to Green Bay in the Super Bowl, then Parcells left, it seemed like that was a lot of those guys went on to win a couple more Super Bowls with the Patriots, but it seemed like that 96 team that went 11-5 and was loaded, it seemed like they were about to sort of explode and go on a run. What happened? Was it Pete Carroll?
There were two things that happened. Number one, that next year, especially toward the end of the season, we were plagued with injuries. All of a sudden, we get late in the season, and that's no small thing. You know, that makes things really difficult. I forget the entire list of guys that were hurt, but it was a lot as we got late in the season. But the biggest thing that happened that prevented that team from going on and being a somewhat of a dynasty, and I remember saying that at the time because people obviously would ask, hey, is this a one-time thing, or can you guys go on and really make a run? And I remember saying, well, it's going to depend on what we do with these draft picks, because we got a bunch of draft picks when Parcells left and then Curtis left. We had a bunch of draft picks in the first couple rounds for, I think, 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember saying, all right, well, if we use those wisely, then we've got a chance, because, you know, if you draft, and it's even more important now than it was then, but if you draft well, then you have depth and you have replacement guys that can replace guys that get priced out of the market and so on. And of those, I think there were like 7 draft picks in the first 2 rounds. I think Robert Edwards was the only one that ended up playing a significant role, and then he got hurt. So those draft picks really didn't pan out, and I think that more than anything kept that team from just rolling forward. You know, that's why when Pete went to when he went to Seattle, he made sure that he had front office control so that he didn't allow that situation to repeat itself.
So you never got the sense, and that was a perception around here while he was here, and I think it's because he followed Parcells, who was such a towering figure, that Carroll was in over his head. That wasn't the case?
No. I think if you talk to guys that played for him at the time, I think everybody, everybody liked playing for Pete, and he was a good coach then, but I think that the personnel side of things, and the fact that we didn't draft well enough to replace the guys that became high priced free agents, that was more the story than anything else. Now there are nuances to Pete, and obviously his personality when he was following Parcells. You know, you're not going to follow that kind of personality, and especially in Boston, you know, it didn't play well. But I always felt like Pete was an outstanding football coach, and he certainly has gone on to prove that both at the college and pro level now.
Did you get the sense that those couple of weeks, were you pissed off the way it ended? Did you feel like Parcells was not completely focused on that Super Bowl while he was, you know, kind of flirting with the Jets?
You know, the thing that was disappointing about that was that we really we'd kind of come out of nowhere to make this run to the Super Bowl, and we get there, and the story wasn't about, you know, none of the stories were about great run that this great and unlikely run that our team had made to get to the Super Bowl. It was just all about Bill and him leaving to go to the Jets and that whole deal. And that part was frustrating. To build a team that makes it to the Super Bowl and then immediately, you know, jump ship and to be talking with another organization while you're on your way to the Super Bowl, I really didn't like that whole situation.
Did you think, so you played in that Super Bowl, you lost to Green Bay, did you think after coming off, Brady hurts his ankle, you play in the second half, you come in the second quarter, play well in the game, you win the game, that was actually, I could be wrong, you might correct me, I think that's the last 1 week break in between the AFC Championship game and the Super Bowl was that year, right? It was just a week in between the games. Did you think you were going to start that week for Brady against St. Louis?
I didn't know. You know, obviously, I certainly wanted to, and was hopeful that was going to be the case. And then I forget whether it was like Tuesday or Wednesday or something like that that Bill called me in and said that Tommy was going to start, which was wasn't very happy about it. You know, it was like one of those deals. Okay, well, he went through this whole thing, got hurt, did the right thing, stood by the team, and then you know, get a chance to play well, and then you just go right back to the bench. It was that was just the whole thing was really a, It was an emotionally taxing year, to say the least.
But now it's been, you know, 15 years or whatever. Whenever you come back here, you got voted into the Hall of Fame, I think, by the largest percentage ever. You come back here now, and I know it ended bitterly, but it's like, you know, that for a fan perspective, I think most fans feel like they don't think about that part when they think you. They think of the 8 or 9 years before that. And that's what happens, I guess, over time, right?
Sure, and that's how I view it too. You know, I mean, the end of it was, you know, it was bittersweet. But man, I loved the time that I got to spend out there, and you know, wouldn't trade that for the world. And it feels so great to come back. And actually, when I come back now to Boston, it's kind of a really cool relationship with the fans where it's. It's more like, it's almost like everybody feels like we're buddies, you know, as opposed to, you know, this, like, you know, big quarterback guy. If I'm walking down the street, you know, somebody's saying, hey, Drew, what's up, man? How are you? Just, hey, great, how are you? And it's a very cool thing when I come back there because it's obviously very welcoming but it's less of a, you know, less of a, like a, you know, football star kind of relationship and more of a, just like, you know, people have a sense that we're just friends, which is a very cool thing to be able to feel like.
So how long has this double back wine been going on for? What's the history with this?
Yeah, man, we've been at this double back thing for quite a while now. We recently released our 7th vintage. It's going very, very well for us, man. My little hometown out here, this little small town of Walla Walla, has sort of producing some of what we really feel like, and I think the critics would agree with us. You know, some of the best wine grapes in the world are being grown in Walla Walla, and you know, we're the beneficiary of that. So we've been having a ton of fun with it, and you know, it's given me a good excuse to come back to Boston a little bit. And you know, my wife and we were out there for 9 years. When we got there, I was single, and she came out and moved in, and we ended up having 3 kids while we were out there. All 3 boys were born at Newton Wellesley Hospital, so we grew up out there. So it's really fun to have this wine deal be an excuse to come back and spend more time back there where we really grew up. And as a matter of fact, as we're sitting here talking today, and I don't know when this will run, but today is our 20th wedding anniversary.
So, look at that! Congratulations!
I don't know, but it was.
What better way to spend it than a podcast with me? I'm sure that's.
Yeah, exactly.
The wine business
is going really, really well, and we're enjoying it, and gives us an excuse to go travel and call it work, and it's been really nice as an excuse to get back to Boston a bit.
It's an insane business. I was looking at before we had John. I was reading some stuff. It's different reports. It's a $40 billion. Not your business, obviously, but the wine business in the U.S. is $40 billion a year.
Yeah, and growing.
Right.
You know, there a lot of the younger generation they're getting into and learning about wine and seeking out different stuff. But it's because it's such a big business, it is highly competitive. And in order to be successful at it, you know, you've got to do everything right. You know, you can't just get the wine in the bottle right. That's not enough. You know, you've got to have a story. You got to get out and work the market and talk to people, and it's at our end of the spectrum, it's a very personal business. There, you know, if you want people to buy wine from you, not just once but year over year, you know, I've got to go see people and talk to them and tell them the story and all of that. And I enjoy that part of it. It means quite a bit of travel, but I enjoy that part.
But is it legit for you? I mean, is it legit like? Full-time job, or are you just sort of the guy who runs it and you're famous and you show up and shake some hands and everyone's like, oh, it's Drew Bledsoe. I mean, because if I'm you, right, so if I make, you know, X amount of money, whatever, tens of millions of dollars, my natural reaction would just be to say, screw it, I'm going to play golf, I'm going to hang out with the kids, I'm not going to push myself, I'm going to enjoy retirement. But at the same time, I mean, we're virtually the same age. What do you do if you retire when you're 35 or 36 years old? I guess, right? You got to do something.
Yeah, well, that's the problem, right? You know, you're 35 years old. You know, all you do is get in trouble if you just retire and hang out. You know, but for me, the intriguing part of this business has been to take on the challenge of growing something from literally from the ground up and seeing if I can make a successful business. I mean, it'd be you know, very easy to just take a bunch of money and, you know, throw a bunch of money at a winery and you know, end up with your name on a bottle and do that. But that part, you know, it's really, that'd be the easy way to do it. But I took it on. I wanted to see if I could build a really successful and thriving business as well. And that's a much different kind of challenge. You know, you're actually watching your bottom line. You're actually taking your marketing seriously, and you're trying to build the structure around your company properly so that you can function and all of those things. Having to register as a lobbyist and go work in Boston
right.
to get shipping legalized, and so that part of it, it's more the challenge of, can I take on something new? Can I, you know, can I start something that's not entirely reliant on my right arm and build that from the ground up? And that's been the challenge, and that's the part that gets me out of bed and gets me going in the morning. And we're getting there. You know, we're actually a profitable business that's doing well, and want to continue to grow that and do it responsibly. But it's been a good challenge. It's been a lot of fun.
How many takes was it for Jerry Maguire? How many takes was it for you?
Jerry Maguire?
Yeah.
I nailed that first take.
You did, really? One and done?
I'm a great actor. I came back from that after the movie was released. I remember Bruce Armstrong telling me, he goes, yeah, I watched the movie. He goes, but, you know, I just didn't buy it, man. You as an NFL quarterback.
Not authentic?
That's a stretch. Not authentic at all.
Were you with, I don't even remember, were you with Cruz, or were you talking, you were on the phone with him or something?
No, my part, I was on the phone with him. We weren't
right.
We weren't acting together. I think he was afraid that I would steal the scene from him and tarnish his name.
You know the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon game, right?
Oh, of course, yeah.
So can you tie yourself in to Kevin Bacon? I can do it for
you. Well,
yeah,
that's only 1 degree. Yeah, it's like me and Tom Cruise and
a few good men.
Tom Cruise and Tom Cruise and Kevin Bacon in. A few good men. Yeah. So
there you go. See, so
it's only 1 degree.
That was your only. That's your only acting credit on IMDb. Nothing else. You weren't ever offered. Mary, right?
I got offered this Something About Mary deal.
Why didn't you do it,
brothers? They wanted me to give up part of my summer, and when your summer is so short,
yeah.
I just didn't want to go travel to Florida to go shoot it, so just didn't go. In retrospect, certainly should have, but I think Brett was actually the third choice for that one, which I know he probably hates to hear, but I think it was me and Steve Young were the first two. You know, the Farrelly brothers, being Boston guys, wanted me in there, and then Cameron Diaz was a 49ers fan, so she wanted Steve Young, Steve couldn't do it, and so Favre was actually the third choice for that movie, which I don't know that he loves to hear that.
Well, there you go. Well, Drew, I appreciate it, and thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Yeah, man, absolutely, it's been fun.
All right, thanks a lot, Drew. Thanks for listening to Enough About Me with Kirk Minahan. If you want more great podcasts, it's pretty easy. You can go to the WEEI mobile app. You can go to Stitcher. You can go to iTunes. You can look up Enough About Me with Kirk Minahan. You can find the ones with Sean McDonough, Bob Ryan, Dan Shaughnessy, David Portnoy. There'll be more. And what you can do when you like them, you write a review. That'll help us out a lot. You give us a rating. We can help you. You can help us. Get that done. Do it right now.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.